Hello and welcome to the After Ellen podcast.
You were at the Let Women Speak event in New York City.
Correct.
Was that the first event of its type that you'd been to?
No. I mean, I'm 75 years old, and I'm a lifelong, you know, lesbian feminist activist. So no. But I've done protests. Recently, I've engaged in protests and demonstrations. I was in Loudoun County last year with respect to parental rights. You know, the teenage boy who identified, I guess, as gender fluid or non-binary or something like that, raped some girls because he was allowed access to. In the schools, to the school bathrooms that had been reserved for girls, and you know, so no, it wasn't the first event of its type, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so at that Loudoun County event, which thank you so much for being there, by the way, that's really close to my old stomping grounds of D.C., and I followed that case really closely. So at that point, the school board had tried to cover up the rape.
Yeah,
and so there was a lot of parental outcry. And like protests and stuff, right? Wasn't there quite a bit of uproar?
Yeah, it was really the parents of Loudoun County, really, that was the beginning of when they really started to get organized against transgenderism, I think was really the center of it. I mean, since then, some other issues have kind of been added onto it.
Of parental rights in general, yeah.
Well, they're anti-CRT. You know, it's become a more, I would say, a Republican agenda. You know, I would say that coalition of parents, that initial coalition of parents, mm-hmm. was somewhat responsible for getting Governor Youngkin elected in Virginia for starters,
yes.
Who's the Republican who unseated the incumbent Democrat.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, who's that, Terry McAuliffe or something?
So,
you know, even though that protest was, I imagine, pretty loud and there was a lot of shouting and maybe some, like, very raised tempers, nevertheless, the crowd was nothing like, it wasn't like protesters and anti-protesters like at the New York event, I imagine.
Well, they were both sides present, but mm-hmm. it was quite civilized, I thought.
So what initially made you want to go to the one in New York, the Let Women Speak protest?
Well, I wouldn't have missed it.
You wouldn't have missed it. You go to all those type of things.
If I possibly can, absolutely.
Yeah.
It's just, I mean, why wouldn't we?
Mm-hmm. So were there a lot of other lesbian women at the Let Women Speak?
There was certainly some. I mean, I would say that there were. I would say that most of the women at the New York event are lesbian, but I'm not. I mean, I didn't do it. I didn't ask them.
You didn't take a survey beforehand.
No, and I know that some of them are not lesbian often.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess I asked that question because I'm curious, you know, who was organizing it and who the predominant groups are there. Because in the case of the Loudoun County one, you know, the majority of the people making up that protest are parents. And a lot of those parents have a Republican or right-leaning political bias. You were able to, you know, see that's the primary stakeholder at that protest, and you're able to see that. So I guess I'm wondering if it was similar with the Women First protest in that you could be like, okay, these are the usual suspects. These are the women that I see
at protest. Let Women Speak protest, you mean?
Yeah. Or if it was really diverse and it was all types of people that you didn't recognize, all of them. And
I recognized most of them. It was Kelly J. Keene's, event. She was the organizer of her own tour, mm-hmm. as you probably know.
I do, but our listeners might not. So I'm
okay,
gonna ask
right.
A bunch of dumb questions.
No, not Not at all. So Kelly J. Keen organized a tour. Kelly J. is a citizen of the UK, and she wanted to. She organized a series of events at major cities throughout the United States, and the New York was scheduled to be her last stop before returning to the UK.
In a way, the biggest, because maybe the most anti-woman crowd, like the largest anti-woman crowd, because it's New York.
Well, New York is big and loud, and I mean, I'm a New Yorker. It's my town. It's how New York does things.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I think another factor is that the counter protesters had practice, right? Because
yeah.
New York was the last stop, so they were on a learning curve from how things went on the previous stops. It was their last chance to show their power.
You make a really good point. They, of course, kicked up quite a fuss in Portland, and I know that there was considerable protest in Austin as well. I mean, everywhere she went, there was protest, but some cities, they were straight-up assaults, like in Tacoma. Wasn't it Tacoma, or was it Seattle? A woman was assaulted.
Tacoma, I believe.
Yeah, so they had this learning curve. They were able to, like, raise the alarm in whatever previous cities and see what each of those cities' activists were doing. And I imagine a lot of people traveled into the New York City protest, our side or their side.
Yes, I guess so. But there were a number of them throughout the country. So there were a few people. Yeah, there were. I know that there was a woman there from Colorado who some people did do that. But for the most part, I would say we were fairly. Fairly local, northeast types.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, the other, just to go back for a moment, I think the other thing that that the counter protesters may have learned from the previous Let Women Speak events was how far they could push police without getting arrested.
Yes.
And so they escalated each time. And by New York, it was their last chance. And they really pushed the boundaries in New York. And fortunately, you know, they did get arrested. NYPD, and especially New York City's counterterrorism squad, was perfectly willing to make arrests.
Wow.
In fact, there were 9 or 11, something like that, arrests made. I saw one of them immediately. One of them happened right in front of me, and of a woman who I'm pretty sure was on testosterone. She had a little beard and stuff, and she was calling herself the rabbi's son, embarrassingly. And she was very aggressive. She's very physically aggressive, and at one point she leaped over the very flimsy partition.
Mm-hmm.
Was serving as a barrier between the counter protesters and us, who were trapped, as you may have been aware, between a high metal fence with spikes on top of it on the one hand, and these flimsy barricades, and half a dozen cops on the other hand, and on the other side were 100 counter protesters. So she right away, early on, she jumped right over the barricade, and immediately to policemen, or maybe it was one of the private security and policemen. I think that's who it was. One private security and one New York City policeman wrestled her to the ground and held her there, pinned her to the ground, and handcuffed her, and took her away. And when she was finally allowed up in cuffs, I could see that there was a little bit of blood coming from her lip. And the look on her face was, I would say more than anything else, shock. She was utterly, utterly surprised utterly surprised and speechless that
her behavior was not going to be condoned.
That she was not being seen as a hero, perhaps.
Wow. It sounds like she had a bad case of roid rage.
Well, the whole crowd did. The whole crowd did that.
Yeah,
I mean, the ones on the boys on estrogen were. I mean, there was the one who got photographed a lot.
The one without his shirt on.
Yeah, the one without his and his 12-year-old breasts. You know, 12-year-old girl breasts. Except that he was a boy, and he was raving his fists around and saying, "These hands do not discriminate. These hands do not discriminate."
Yes, you know, I saw that. So. I want to come back to the barriers, so don't let me forget about that. But I am just realizing in your description of his 12-year-old breast buds, the pedophilic, you know, influence of having like these synthetic hormones producing this very slight, like really prepubescent girl body change, and how putting that out there is like pedophilia culture. It really puts it in your face that, right? Like that's not normal female woman development. It doesn't look like an adult woman's chest.
In a way, I'm not interested.
Yeah.
And what interests me about what you said is, I guess, is that there seems to be a coalition, a political coalition, between big pharma, between autogynephilic men, and also with pedophiles, which is, you know, it's an old alliance, and those three strands and perhaps other antisocial strands have also come together to produce this terrible antisocial movement. So it's not surprising to see pieces from all of those strands.
Yeah, that is a really interesting subtlety to just the imagery that we saw coming out of the protest. So I want to return to the barricades because Kay Yang on my friend Isabella's podcast, His Body Is It podcast, was describing that they had requested those barricades be put up, and then the police delivered the barricades but did not actually put up the barrier. So the women, did you encounter this? Did you see this happening? The women were the ones barricading and deciding, like, how are they going to keep themselves safe during?
Yes, we were deciding what was the best way to, and I think it was a good decision because by putting our backs to this high fence with spikes on it that was the front of City Hall, the City Hall property, it meant that the counter-protesters couldn't easily get behind us. They couldn't encircle us and kettle us, right? Then control us that way. And it also meant that the police only had to protect one side of us. They didn't have to worry so much about our backs, although, in theory, at least, there was a way to go around several blocks away and get into that property, but nobody did. And by the time that might have been tried, and eventually the counterterrorism force did in fact go inside the City Hall property and protect our backs. But that, I think, in any case, I think that was a good decision by us, by the protesters, by Kay Yang and Amanda Stillman and, you know, the other protesters to make as short a line as possible that needed to be defended by the police. What wasn't so good, in my opinion, was the proximity. I mean, if I had been doing it, I would have insisted that they be on the other side of the street.
Yes. Right. They were pushing against the barricades, and did that mean that the barricades were pushing into the group of women speaking?
Well, so, yeah, in theory, I guess, and at times it was a little, you know, I wondered whether the police were going to be able to hold 100 protesters when there were only 6 of them.
Oh my God!
And the barricade line, the barricades, you know, their units, their little fence units that hook together, and they were starting to come apart. Some of them were coming apart, mm-hmm. and they were off the ground. They were being raised, and they were being moved. They were being moved sometimes toward us, but on the other hand, the half dozen cops did know what they were doing,
uh-huh.
and pushed back, effectively using these metal fence like pieces to
right.
To push back on the
protesters were sorry to interrupt you, go ahead.
There was a moment or two, several points when I wondered if the police were going to be able to maintain a separation. And I found myself just sort of looking to see what the escape routes were for me, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Being aware as the situation is unfolding, what is my escape route if this actually becomes violent?
Well, it was already violent, and the question was whether in the next moment they were going to come into the space and try to trap us against the City Hall fence.
Jesus Christ. So did it feel really claustrophobic?
No, I wasn't aware of it. I wasn't even aware of how I felt, you know.
Oh, wow.
I don't care how I felt either. I was angry. I was really fucking angry at them.
You were angry, but you weren't aware of your own emotions. It was just like, okay,
well, I didn't have any emotions except I wanted to kill them. I mean, honestly.
Yeah.
And I don't think our emotions actually are, you know, I'm not sure our emotions are important. It's our behavior that's important to me.
Probably to our readers, they're important to know, like, what was it like for you and for other women? Because I think when we see those, the footage, it looked like a fucking war zone. It was just psychotic.
Well, it may be like that. I've never served in the armed forces, but it may be, in fact, something like that. Where you try to do the right thing regardless of how you feel.
Yes. And also, you know, you can feel more than one thing at a time, and the predominant emotion is not cowardice in spite of multiple emotions coming up at once, like maybe I don't want to be here. I don't want to experience this, but I'm so angry. So Kelly J. Keene didn't even get to speak.
She wasn't allowed. Well, she sort of wasn't. In effect, she wasn't allowed through the crowd. She, I mean, you can listen to her talk about it, but and we didn't know this. Maybe somebody knew this. Maybe Kay Yang and Amanda Stillman knew about it, but I didn't know. What I knew was that it was late and it was time for her to be there. And I also didn't, you know, it was clear that there was no way for her to get in without being escorted. And as it turned out, she wasn't escorted. Now, I did see another woman who had left. She'd been there. She'd been there early on with me. And she had left, I think, to find a bathroom locally, and she tried to come back, and the police wouldn't let her, and they told her she couldn't come back.
Mm.
She didn't comply. She just jumped over the fence. And
nice.
So, and, you know, I can see how Kelly J would not be able to do that. She, you know, she's in, her face is known.
Right, absolutely. She could have been attacked. So I want to talk about the police a little bit, because I'm hearing that they were well trained. They knew what they were doing. You said they knew what they were doing, even though there were only six of them. But it also sounds like they, while they did know what they were doing once the situation was beginning to unfold, it seems like they really did not come prepared, considering that they didn't put the barrier up and they probably didn't expect 100 topless trannies.
They underestimated, completely underestimated the counter-protesters and the violence of the counter-protesters. I think they were imagining a bunch of gay men who who wanted to be drag queens, who were flouncing around with limp wrists or some damn thing. I don't know. I can't even imagine. But they were completely unprepared, and it's ridiculous that they were unprepared, because if they had seen what had happened in other cities on this tour, they would have had a better. But I think they had a fixed idea, if they had any idea at all. Actually, I overheard and then participated in a conversation with a police officer early on that was that it was just an eye roller for me. A woman cop said, "What's this about?" She asked a male cop. And the male cop said, "Okay, so those ones say they exist, and these ones say they don't exist."
No.
I said, and I just interrupted. I'm a police, sir. Yeah, I mean, you don't have to be a genius, I guess, to be a police officer in New York City, which is disappointing, but that's what it is. And so I interfered, because the woman cop still looked puzzled. And I said, that's not what it's about. It's about that those people are insisting that men can be women, and they don't want us to say that men can't be women.
And
they're
that's
here to
really
shut
it.
Us. And we know that men can't be women, and they want to shut us up. That's what I said. And she said, she looked as though she suddenly comprehended it. And for a moment, I got really hopeful. I was happy until she started to speak, because her response was, "Oh, of course, because God created men and women, and you can't go against God's will." And she went on about Adam and Eve.
Oh.
I just stopped. I guess it was better than they don't exist than they do exist. But
right. I think it sounds like you're hurting their feelings. Why can't you just call them she? That's the other extreme. It's because Jesus doesn't want men to wear dresses. Like, that's not what we're saying.
It's fine. I mean, maybe that's the only way that she could understand it. It's fine.
Well, it doesn't really matter if you get to this point by walking or swimming, right? As long as you understand that men can never be women.
Well, we can, I guess. I mean, I did a little better with the cab driver who took me away from there when it was all over.
Tell me that story.
Because he wanted to know what it was about, and he was well read. He understood much better than the cops did what the issues were. And he said, "Okay, so I get why why they shouldn't be in sports. You don't want these guys in women's sports. That's not fair." And I said, "Right." And he said, "But why can't they be in bathrooms, for God's sakes?"
Oh,
those women. And I said, "'Cause they're men and they're creeps, and why would a man want to be in a women's bathroom? And they're, you know, and some of them are rapists, and what a perfect place to, if you're a rapist, to have an opportunity." And he said, "You mean that?" And he said, "You mean they're not castrated?" I said, "No."
Wow.
overwhelmingly, these guys who claim to be women overwhelmingly are not castrated. He said, oh!
Yeah, they're
so,
their dicks still.
So, and it doesn't even matter. I mean, they're still perverts who you don't want in your private spaces, for God's sake. So
I love that he got it in that moment, though. Like, think about the type of man that wants to be in a women's restroom, whether he has a penis or not. Think about that type of man. What are his motivations for doing this? Does it then make a difference to you if he's castrated or not?
Well, that's what I think. I'm not sure he got that part of it.
Yeah, but
at least he did better than the cops. I'll give him a
yeah,
B.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, like, so many people really have no understanding that transgenderism honestly doesn't have a coherent definition, even amongst transgender identified people. And none of it requires, you know, surgical or chemical castration, although that's often the result.
If they're reading mainstream media or listening to mainstream media, or if they're on social media even, they're very likely, like the cab driver was reasonably well informed, and he was under this impression that there was a requirement if you're transgender to have been and that's, it's understandable that he had that understanding. It's not his fault. Once he understood it, he understood it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I can't relate to people who would let a castrated man go to the same bathroom and listen to little girls pee and offer them tampons and stuff like that. But I can understand where they think, oh, well, everyone's safe, like, you know, from actually being raped.
I don't think anybody thinks that. I think the people who say it are lying.
Mm-hmm. So I want to go back to the counter-protesters. There was a lot of AGPs there. There were a lot of people on hormones. I know that the man who was saying my cysts don't discriminate is like a professional model or something. But you had mentioned the Antifa element. So I want to get another sense of the crowd. Like, this is trans activists. This is far leftist. This is anarchist. What is this?
It was a motley crew. I had an interesting experience at, toward the end. Eventually what happened, as you probably know, is that women did speak. Rev Fox came by with a very excellent audiovisual setup and recorded us one by one speaking as if it was a normal Let Women Speak event. It was pretty clear. As it turned out, the recording of that was pretty clear despite the exceedingly loud and close range noise. I mean, I was, you know, we were all equipped with earplugs, which was great. They were very effective. Earplugs are very effective. You could hear yourself speak. And her, you know, the Rev Fox's microphone right in our mouths, you know, was also very effective. So that was good. So when I was, when I spoke, and I spoke intensely, you know, because there was a lot of adrenaline, but also the content of what I was saying was intense, I think, or at least I felt intense about it. There's the feelings again. I talked initially about as lesbians, what we, this is, you know, this is my town. New York is my town.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I remember New York, my town, in the 1970s, and what we as lesbians had. We had this whole lesbian culture. It was our town. We had bars all over. We had resources all over. We had restaurants all over. We had businesses, bookstores. We had this whole network of lesbian-owned businesses operating for the benefit of lesbians everywhere, all over the city and beyond the city, in fact, in the suburbs as well. And I said that, and I expressed my anger about the loss of that to the transgender, the transgender ideology. And then I went on to talk about the fact that they are losing, and what's helping them lose is their actions.
Yeah, like the exactly
right?
The behavior.
And that my advice to them, as a wise old woman, is to get out now, because they're going to lose, and they're too fragile to bear losing easily. They're not going to be able to handle losing because of their emotional fragility.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think they should just abandon it. Now this is a turning point. And when I finished speaking, at some point when I started, there was silence. There was relative silence in the crowd, in the Antifa crowd, among the counter protesters, when I started speaking about lesbian spaces in New York. It was as though they were listening.
Well, I bet a lot of women were hearing you.
But then when I started talking about their losing, they got,
yeah,
apparently,
yeah.
I would say that they got angry, and suddenly one counter protester with a large drum started drumming really loudly, and everybody else chimed in. They wanted to drown out the part where I was saying, you're going to lose. And they didn't, because, as they say, the microphone was very effective, both locally and on the eventual tape. Both microphones worked very well. So I finished talking about that amidst this amazing din. And I was reading from a script that I had written, right? And I looked up from my script as I finished, and my eyes met a woman who I would say was about in her early 50s. And she looked normal, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
She didn't look like Antifa. She looked like a regular 52-year-old New Yorker.
Yeah.
And I thought, she's probably somebody's mother.
Oh, God.
She's probably a mother of somebody who's a transgenderist activist.
Right.
And she was looking at me. She was looking at me. I guess that's why. I mean, she caught my eye because she stood out from the rest of that crowd, and also because of her, you know, age and appearance, she looked so normal. But also because she was staring at me, which was understandable because I had just been speaking, right? And and our eyes met for a moment, and she couldn't sustain it. She, after about a second and a half, she looked down. She looked down. She looked. I couldn't read it. Maybe it was shame. Maybe it was worry. Maybe it was worry for her fragile child, who I had just called out as fragile and unable to handle loss. I don't know what it was, but it was an interesting moment of connection. I thought it was an interesting moment of connection that we had in that second and a half.
Oh, that's so deep. I love that.
She may have had a change of heart one way or the other. I mean, she may have hated me, saying I have no idea what it was, but something happened there.
Right.
So that's just an answer to your question about what was the crowd like. And I would say that, it was, there were some stars there. Eli Ehrlich was there, right?
Oh, God.
I know. And then the model was there, and the rabbi's quote unquote son was there, and I would say mostly the crowd was under 30 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And more male than female, but not by much. Whereas we were, you know, and there, we were very diverse, you know. We were, there were a few men, but mostly we were women, and at half or more were lesbians, and we were all ages.
I know that probably the women who were on the side of the trans rights activists, probably a lot of them are lesbians who identify, you know, with masculinity more than they feel comfortable doing as a woman or something. So I really wonder if they could hear you and feel that moment of doubt in everything they were doing, because like exactly like you were saying, the lesbian scene in New York has been so central to the development of lesbian feminism.
Well, it was where the women's liberation movement started in the late 1960s. It started in New York City. It started in New York City. And it was started by lesbians.
And
right?
Those women, yes, and those women must have had some part of them light up thinking about the freedom that was created from that spark. I mean, how could
I think that's why
that?
They weren't. I think that's why they were not trying to drown me out when I was talking about that. They were genuinely interested in hearing it.
Yeah.
Until I started to, you know, drag on them a little bit.
Oh, sister, I hope that planted a seed. I mean, you really could have gotten into their subconscious mind and.
Oh, that's the idea.
Yeah.
Although mostly I don't have hope of converting them with ideas or feelings. I have hope of defeating them.
Mm-hmm.
In the public mind.
Yeah. So let's talk about that a little bit more. So you've been an activist for so long, and I imagine that in all this time, you probably have a lot of tips for what strategies work the best in this kind of work. And so I'm wondering if you can share with our audience some of the things that you've learned to be the most effective for strategy.
I don't know. I'm no expert, really. I think we ought to be talking about this, though. I think this is a really important question that you're asking. My own inclinations are so okay. So my thoughts about this are that the most effective way to win this is we can get a clue to what the most effective way to win is by looking at past civil rights struggles that have been successful, where the oppressed minority has won, and look at what they did and look at what they had in common. And to my eye, I look at the suffragettes, I look at Gandhi, I look at Martin Luther King, and what they had in common, and they were all successful. They were all three wildly successful in changing public hearts and minds, and that's where you win, right?
Mm-hmm.
They didn't change the oppressors' minds. They changed the minds of the public. Right? So, and then the oppressors were disempowered. So the way, to my eye, the way what they all had in common, and this is not an accident because they all copied each other. I mean, the suffragettes came first and devised this method, and it was copied and expanded by Gandhi, and then it was copied and adapted by Martin Luther King. And that is, look, you're the oppressed minority isn't going to win against a bigger, stronger, state-sponsored bunch of haters with weapons, right? They're just not going to win. They're going to be eliminated. They're going to be damaged. They're going to be killed. They're going to be disappeared. So what the suffragettes did, and it was their genius. As far as I know, they originated it. I don't know that there was anybody who came before them who did this. What they did was nonviolent resistance. And the object of nonviolent resistance is to show the public the violence and the ugliness of the oppressor. It's not to, you know, it's not. That's the goal, is to force the oppressor to show his brutality.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Okay. So true for all the examples that you gave. Yeah.
So what you want to do is not fight back. You can't win. You can't win when you fight back with your fists or with your mace or with your guns or with your knives or with your hatpins. You can't win that way because they have more brute force and they have more practice using it. What you can do is force them, is force them to show their brutality to the world.
Wow. This is such wise advice. This is really true.
Well, it's not original. There's a thing called nonviolent direct action, or NVDA, and I think it's our best shot at winning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So in that light, you know, and with the benefit of hindsight, do you think that the Standing for Women event could have done anything differently to be more effective or safer?
I don't think the idea is to be safe. Safety is not the goal here. Safety is what I just said. Safety is
counterproductive.
The goal is to make the oppressor show their brutality.
So maybe take the barriers away next. just let them come at you.
I think it was very useful to show the utter disregard for the police. I think the police were peak trans.
I should hope so.
Yeah, I don't. The police globally have been part of the problem. Police departments across the world have been captured by transgender ideology. And,
so true.
And New York City, of course, is a blue city in a blue state. And it has a blue blue mayor and a blue governor. So it's good to peek the cops, was my point.
Yeah, it all starts with the cops getting into the pride parades, right? And then it escalates to where you see images, like there was a really popular image going around of, I don't remember if it was an Australian or New Zealand trans-identified male who's working as a cop and, you know, in woman face, and his police uniform has the pride flag on it.
Right.
And can you imagine being a woman who calls the police for a domestic violence situation and this hulking man dressed in makeup and a ponytail shows up? I mean, it's just
right.
Disgusting.
Right. Well, it gives the lie to any kind of fairness by the police. And you know, if the police want to have credibility, and the police do want to have credibility, and governments want the police units to have credibility. But
right.
they're taking steps, and that kind of action certainly undermines police credibility. And the result of not having police credibility is civil disobedience and uncivil disobedience. I mean, that's what, you know, you want anarchy, you want violent demonstrations like this that wind up with people getting hurt and lots of arrests. Is that what you want? Because that's what you're going to get. If the police have no authority and no credibility. People are going to be doing this to the police. People are going to be shooting police.
Well, I really hope that they, not only were they peak trans, but I hope they were able to see how their, whatever judgments they had made, and who are we to know what their judgments were, but whatever judgments they had made about the crowd that they were going to encounter were also completely blown up. And maybe they'll realize that these people are much more like any of the most violent, easily activated, easily drawn and, you know, triggered into attacking people.
They're violent thugs who are not emotionally real.
Or anybody else.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think that, I think the images, you know, the photographs are so powerful.
Mm-hmm.
Photographs of the lunch counters in the 1950s being desegregated and the violence that was done to the black people, black protesters, was so effective in changing American hearts and minds. It was just so, the pictures, right? And it just seems to me that the pictures from Kelly J's tour, and especially from New York, are bound to have, I don't think the dust to have an effect. I don't think the dust has settled yet on how effective those things are. And also, we're not going to stop protesting. We're not going to stop doing this. There are going to be more tours, and there are going to be more protests, and there are going to be more amazing photographs.
And they're going to lose.
And they're going to lose, yeah. Yep. They
inevitable.
Can't help but lose.
Yeah.
Yeah, because once you see who they are and once you look at their arguments, it all falls apart very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
They can't, I mean, that's why they want to keep us quiet, is because if their ideas are debated or subject to examination.
Yes.
Right. And if their violence shows, and if their violence and brutality is shown in pictures, they're also going to lose. It's all, and they know it, you know, they know it. That's why that woman, who I think was some trans mother, why she looked so upset, whatever the content of that upset was.
Mm-hmm.
She knows we're going to lose.
So where can women hear your speech that you gave and all the speeches?
Oh, yeah, there's a good, Rev Fox has it, R-E-V-F-O-X-X,
okay.
All one word. I think on YouTube and maybe on Facebook, and you can find the, actually, if you go to my, I don't know how public I am, but yeah, anyway, you can find it.
Okay.
I was going to say you could find it on my Facebook page, but I think I have that locked down.
Yeah, you don't want anybody from the internet knowing what your Facebook page
is. I don't care. You know, at this point, I honestly, I'm so not closeted about any of this.
Oh, no. There's nothing left to closet, but the, you know, you don't want, like, randoms trying to send you shit on Facebook.
Oh, you know, block.
Is there anything that I should have asked you that I didn't?
No, I made, like, four notes, bullet point notes, and I think I hit them all. I think you did very well.
Oh, thank you. I thought this was an incredible interview. I really, really appreciate all of your insights into both this particular protest and just your knowledge of change movements over the decades.
Well, thank you. I'm still I'm involved with, I'm vice president, actually, of the U.S. chapter of Women's Declaration International. And so, you know, I'm well informed about this movement. I've been involved with WDI USA since its inception, three or four years ago. And, So, I'm well informed on this, and I'm an old second waver.
Yeah.
From New York, and a women's liberationist, and an old dyke. So, that's that's where my experience comes from.
All the women who write for After Ellen, and who, well, also Gay, I'll include Gay, even though she doesn't write, she owns After Ellen, are in the tradition of second wave feminists, although most of us were not alive yet. But I think that most of our readers are normal people who don't understand the trans issue at all, and who by and large think that there is a cohesive umbrella term called LGBT that describes people that have something in common, when in actuality lesbians have nothing in common with trans people.
I know.
And so I'm really
And as a result
hoping...
of that, yeah, sorry.
Oh, no, go ahead.
No, you're really hoping.
I was just really hoping that this event, if people see these photographs, like you were saying, and this footage of the just absolutely sociopathic male violence driven, truly a portrait of how men react when they are mad at women.
Well, when women say no.
Keep them too. Yes, exactly. When women assert any type of boundary. I mean, look at the barricades themselves are a literal boundary, and it couldn't be respected.
No, they infuriated them. It's a challenge. If you're going to dominate, and they're out to dominate, if you're going to dominate, boundaries must be torn down. You must not have any boundaries.
Annihilated.
So I guess one last thing is I would suggest to people who are active with After Ellen that if you want to get lesbian land back. And by lesbian land, I mean a world in which lesbians have a network, and anywhere in the world we go, we can find our people. If you want that back, because that's what we had in the 1970s. I remember it. I helped create it. I was in New York during the 1970s. I was a women's liberationist. I was a radical feminist. I still am a radical feminist. And I know that there's some tension between some current lesbians and radical feminists. But I'm telling you, if you want to fight this transgenderist juggernaut, the most effective way to do it is to get involved with a radical feminist organization such as WDI or WOLF and come on board. It's we love lesbians. We are lesbians. And we're fighting for all women's sex-based rights, and we're fighting against gender in all its forms. If you're big into butch femme, you're not going to be a good fit. But please understand that that gender is the problem, and because gender is the problem, gender is not going to be the solution.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that so many women will be drawn in to... When I say so many women, I mean normal lesbians who haven't considered this issue yet are going to need to consider it because so many women are commenting, like, what's happening to lesbian bars? Why are there no more women's bookstores? What happened to women's culture? Where are the women's festivals? And the answer is that women are no longer allowed to be a discrete category. Everything you're encountering is women and men too. And so I'm going to need you to look at that. I'm going to need you to look at how gender is getting in the way of women experiencing the vitality, the excitement, the pure bliss of a lesbian-centered cultural product like Mishfest, or like the women's what's that called in Brooklyn? The women's library or women's
Herstory Archives?
Thank you. The Herstory Archives, yes. And that still exists. But there used to be a space like that in every major U.S. city and on most college campuses. And now it's all gender everything.
Right. I think that we also need to have a discussion about gender in the lesbian community. We really have to look at ourselves. We really have to look at butch femme. Butch femme is gender. Butch femme is masculinity and femininity. Butch femme is dom sub.
I was just going to say that.
We really need to do some self-examination about that. Mm-hmm. If we, it's no accident that in the 1970s in New York, in Women's Liberation Central, when we had all of these things, when we created this culture and these businesses and these networks, our personal style was lesbian. It was what you would call androgynous. It's what mm-hmm. people called androgynous, meaning it was ungendered. We were not gendered. It was not opposites attract. We were not about that. We were about equality in all of our relationships.
Non-hierarchical.
Among ourselves. Non-hierarchical, right. And we worked very hard to avoid dominance and submission. And we worked really hard to resist all of the imagery, the romantic imagery around, around dominance and submission. And there is this tension between, as I said, between radical feminists who do have a critique of gender and those lesbians who are invested in butch femme. Because look, butch femme taken to an extreme is women becoming men.
Yeah. Wow. I mean, that's a really tough pill for a lot of women to swallow. And
yep.
I think that especially for a lot of young women who are getting into lesbian community in online spaces, because there aren't very many real world spaces anymore.
Right.
This discourse that you all sisters did, you already had this discourse. You already had these arguments about masculinity and femininity and how those represent dominance and submission and a hierarchy relationship versus androgyny. Or just being yourself, having your personal style just be
equality,
you know,
eroticizing equality.
Exactly. Literally eroticizing equality. Like, yeah. Let's find an eros in liberation. Let's actually
right.
get turned on by our own freedom.
Absolutely.
A lot of women are really encountering butch femme discourse, and I think they want it to be possible to be, I say this because I've seen it in online spaces and I've taken part in it because I've been that young lesbian looking for community online.
Sure.
But, this desire to be able to have the personal style of masculine and feminine to ape these gender roles because you feel called to it as a self-expression and not actually engaging in dominance and submission. Like, I think some women are looking to have their cake and eat it too around gender, you know?
It's very strange logic. And I personally, I get dismayed when I see lesbians on social media saying it's, defending butch femme.
Uh-huh.
When it's very different from what we did when we created lesbian spaces in public to begin with. It's very different. We did self-examination. We looked at, because we understood through consciousness raising, really, we understood that nobody does anything in a cultural vacuum. Nobody does butch femme just because that's how they were born. It's
right, exactly.
It's not personal.
Holding a tube of lipstick.
Right. It's from the culture.
Culture.
It's from the culture, and it's constructed. And what is constructed can be deconstructed. We can.
That's deep. Okay, so we've been on the phone for an hour now. I want to respect your time and not make you keep talking, but you know I've got questions now about if you have advice for women in setting up consciousness raising, because so many of our readers are young and have no idea how to engage in the type of consciousness raising and inner work that leads to world-changing outer work.
Well, funny you should ask. funny you should ask about consciousness raising.
I'm ready. Tell me everything.
It just so happens that I made a how-to instructional video about consciousness raising groups. It's a Women's Declaration International video, and it's on YouTube. If you look up Lauren Levy, that's LauRenLevey, and put that as a keyword, and put in maybe WDI and Radical Feminist Perspectives. That's the series that I was on doing it. It's Marian Ritigliano interviewed me, and I
love Marian.
She's great. So I just spoke for an hour about how to do consciousness raising. If you put in my name, consciousness raising, radical feminist perspectives, it should come up.
Okay. Yes, this is wonderful. I can't wait to share that with our audience. I had numerous different feminist collectives that I worked with over the last decade, and you know, we got really into trying to set our groups up the way that they were set up in the 60s, and we were able to find some old PDFs and stuff that had been archived in the Women's History Archives and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, a YouTube video really laying it out would have really come in handy for us.
Yeah, it's really a good tool. It's a way of getting at what the social structures really are, because it's so hard to do it by yourself when you only have your own experiences. You only have your own data pool. But it's when you start making generalizations based on other women's stories that you can go, that can really get to the heart of stuff. The heart of structures, the heart of the social structures, if you understand them.
Yes. Yes, I always described it to women who would push back and say, like, why can't trans women be in women-only space, saying that the one thing that we all have in common as women is our femaleness, and we can't say that we all have in common our background, our economic class, our race, or so many of these other experiences that put us in multiple cultures at once.
That you want to understand the structures, you want to understand social structures that are oppressing women. Women are oppressed as sex class, mm-hmm. not as a gender. We're not oppressed because we like pink. We're not oppressed because we don't like pink. We're oppressed because we're female, because of our female bodies. And because since we have female bodies, we have a certain utility for men, and they enslave us and they oppress us so that they can extract that utility from us, whether we want to or not. And if we're going to change that, we need to meet as an oppressed sex class. If you you don't invite the fox in to the chicken CR group. He's not on your side. He's just
right,
not on.
Exactly.
His interests are diametrically opposed. There are mm-hmm. only two sex classes, and men aren't the same as us. They are the oppressor class, no matter what they put on.
Yeah. Yeah. No amount of eyeliner will ever change that. So I love the way you put it, and there was something else that you said that I want to go back to really briefly, and that was, I don't remember the exact words that you used, but it kind of pointed to the sovereignty of each woman in the CR group owning her experience, even as she witnesses the experiences of other women. Mm-hmm. I know that's not what you said, but that was mm-hmm. what I had this image of when you were talking about either authority or sovereignty, or I don't remember what you said. Do you remember?
I don't remember saying that, but the power of the consciousness raising group. I mean, you should watch the video. Really, I say it pretty well in there. But it's really about collectivity rather than sovereignty. It's about collectivity. It's about the collectivity of our experiences and looking at that collectivity and seeing really what's common to all of us and what's in our own interest and what things mean, what structures mean. It's about expanding the database. I think I said this to you a moment ago. It's about expanding the database that we have that we use to understand the social structures that we're in beyond just our own personal experience so that we can rely on the collectivity. We need to get past this, you know, I am an island and I am unique. And what consciousness raising is about is commonality and not difference.
Okay, but that is what you were saying that, and I was experiencing the other side of that coin, which is that we experience commonality when we hear one another's stories, but we also create greater room for difference, and holding the diversity of each woman's experience simultaneously with all that we have in common with her, and that is the kind of thing that emerges in consciousness raising that you really can't get in any other dynamic with other women. Like you need the container of women only space in order to experience the universality of so much of our experience and the incredible diversity of our experience as well, because we're all women, but we all come with different
Some things cut across race and economic class and religion and ethnicity and culture. Some things just cut right across, and sexuality.
Exactly.
We have lots of stuff in common with straight women.
That mother looked at you and had that moment of connection because she heard that. She knew exactly what the fuck you were talking about, even though she's been out here living as though this alternate reality where men can be women. Sure, why not?
Yeah, I think the main thing, I think the crucial thing about, well, I was going to say about consciousness raising, but I really mean about living, you know, is just to tell the truth. I don't think we have to try to be different. And I don't think we have to try to be the same. What we have to try to do is understand what we do have in common and what we don't have in common. We don't have to try to be anything we're not. We just have to try to examine what we are.
Wow. These are some wise words. I hope that
they're from a different era. It all seemed so self-evident 50 years ago. I feel like an alien now, but it was common knowledge at one time. So anyway, it's been a pleasure talking to you. It's been a wonderful conversation.
It really has. I appreciate you so much.
Thanks for listening to the After Ellen podcast. If you liked this episode, let us know. Give us a review on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. Or by emailing jocelyn@afterellen.com. Hit that subscribe button. And thank you for listening.